Hey there, beautiful people. Welcome to Fans High, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I'm light, I'm bright, and you better get used to it, Jared Hill.
And I'm Charles Davis, standing in for the often imitated, never duplicated Travella Anderson.
Coming up on the show today, we've got one of our favorites. Charles, is this your third time on the show, I think?
Third, maybe fourth. It's hard to keep track, to be honest.
Something like that. Yeah, Charles has been on the show numerous times. You were, I think one of the first straight people to, really be able to take up some space on the show. Straight man at that.
Fair enough.
And we are really grateful to have you here. Tell people a little bit about who you are and what you do.
I guess I'm your resident smart black person, depending on what the topic may be. By my day job, I'm a professor at the University of Michigan, where my work focuses broadly on issues of race and racism, systemic oppression, and structures of domination. I also have the pleasure of being Jared and Travella's frequent guest for all things light-skinned and thereof. So just glad to be here and glad to stand in. Get my journalist chops brushed off here. See if I can do a good job. Maybe you'll have me back.
Listen, look, don't push it, okay? Let's get through this one first, all right?
Okay.
Travella is real territorial about shit, so.
Fair enough. Could be a throuple.
Well, I mean, listen, we have to talk to the network, but I'm sure something could get worked out.
I think we can work it out.
We got to get into Past the Popcorn. There's an interesting story that comes from the Today Show. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but we never really got to talk about it. Go ahead, Charles.
So last month, a video of Kevin Ford, a 54-year-old black man who worked as an employee of HMS Host, which hires and staffs food service vendors at Las Vegas Airport, posted to Reddit as Ford was acknowledged for having never missed a day of work in 27 years. Mr. Ford received several items from HMS Host, the company contracted to hire employees from restaurants like Burger King and Cinnabon, and included a reusable cup, candy, a movie ticket, and was accompanied by a slice of chocolate cake from local managers. Kevin was on the Today Show, and one of the anchors asked him how he did it. Here's his response.
Just never even thought of missing a day. The manager brought me some a present, and they said, this is, you know, for your 27th year anniversary, and I loved it. I just, you know, I said, let's do a little shout-out video for and stuff. And I was just grateful to have it. I'm still grateful. I've been through a lot. Everybody's been through a lot. So I look toward the smaller things in life, and, you know, I'm grateful for everything. I'm grateful for every day I wake up that I could go to work, that I could be a good citizen, be a good American, and just, you know, do my part.
So while Ford obviously expressed a deep appreciation and recognition in the video, online viewers are a bit more critical, noting that he deserved far greater recognition and reward for his longtime service. Serena Ford, one of Ford's daughters who established a GoFundMe for her father, noted that part of his commitment to consistency was to take care of her and her older sister as a single dad. And in order to maintain his eligibility for retirement, he was steadfast in showing up to work. After Ford's story became viral, more than 8,000 contributions have been made from the donors, with a total of more than $250,000. Now, Jared, when I heard this story, you know, I felt both surprised and kind of sad. How did you kind of take it?
Yeah, so I saw this. B. Scott posted the clip from the Today Show, and I commented on it, and I was trying to figure out what I was feeling, and I wrote, quote, There's something that feels incredibly admirable and exemplary about him and his story, but in a very respectability kind of way that white supremacist capitalism delivers so uniquely. Like, I'm proud of him, but in a way that makes me cringe and question. And I've still never been able to, step away from that feeling even when I wrote it in the quote.
Mm-hmm.
I put my phone down and I was doing something else, and I came back and there were all of these responses to it, and it made people feel all kinds of ways, this clip. And I still don't know how to settle into a feeling about what I'm seeing with him, because it feels really complex.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I sort of heard it, it was kind of in passing almost, right? I mean, it was like a Today Show sort of thing. You saw it on the internet, obviously. And I kind of did a double take, right? I was like, wait, let's rewind. Okay. First of all, absolutely, right? Let's recognize the level of consistency that is, much more difficult in so many different ways. And even to think, right, that part of this 27 years is over the last couple of years during the pandemic. And we know that, you know, folks like, you know, Kevin were very much frontline, right? But also were very vulnerable in the sense that one could not miss work really for any particular reason without the possibility of being terminated. So I started to sort of question, right, all the other folks who weren't in this situation, right, who did and ultimately, you know, could be able to take off work in order to sort of support their families in all the various ways we know that parents have had to show up for their children, other caretaking responsibilities. And yet that sort of same opportunity wasn't afforded to Kevin because of sort of the limit that was placed on him as what I imagine as a wage worker, right, given that working in food services. But as he said, right, he's like, got to take care of these kids. He's got to put them through school. So the option, right, of rest, right, and we can think about that a lot when we talk about what it means in this moment for Black folks to have rest, wasn't available to him. And that really just raised a lot of questions of how we think about labor, right, and work and Black people sort of specifically in those contexts.
It was frustrating to me from a lot of different ways. And I remember as I was listening to the clip again, he says in there, he references himself as wanting to be a good person and a good American. Mm. And that just like, I was like, like, what does that mean to him? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to him? And what informs that? Right. Like, Right. Where did that come from? Right. And I think about how our generation is a generation that we know we don't tend to work at the same place as long as our parents and, you know, the people that came before us. The idea of being at the same company for 27 years is really hard to even really wrap my mind around. Right.
Absolutely.
So I hear that piece of it and I'm like, they brought him a plastic cup and a bag.
Girl, like, listen.
And you listen, well, you know, what I mean? Like, what is going on?
What we not going to right. do? Like, I got cups at the job for all of that. I've been here 27 years, right? We got cups.
Listen.
I got a movie ticket.
What I don't need is something branded, right?
Exactly. Right. And yeah, and they were from like, you know, a host of the companies, I guess, that are a part of this suite that, you know, this corporation works in conjunction with. 27 years, and that's all you have to offer me, right? And also, and so much was lost in that same time period that will never be recovered.
Even to the point that you're making about like there were gifts that came from like the group of companies. I didn't know that piece of it, but it's like, so this didn't even cost them anything.
No.
Right. This was all just like stop.
It wasn't a nice bag, right? That like had his name embroidered on it. Right. Something. It was like, I think it was like a clear plastic bag. And I'm like, this is as much as y'all could muster up in recognition of, you know, what is, I imagine, not just a milestone for Kevin, but for the company.
One of the things that was interesting to me, though, when we were talking about this was you talked about how we make extraordinary the everyday. I really would love for you to unpack how you were thinking about that specifically with this.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of the conversation, both like in the interview that's happening and in the, you know, sort of discourse online, it's sort of like glorifying this grind culture that is so sort of mundane and everyday for people who exist in circumstances where that's, again, a necessity of survival. And it almost sort of, in my perspective, sort of removed our understanding of like Kevin the person, right? It wasn't sort of this description of dignity in all labor, which, you know, I think is really, really important. But it was so focused on like the thing that he did and not the person that he was, right? In so many ways that I think he tries to reassert in these interviews, right? Because in so many ways for himself, it was like, this is just what was necessary. Right. It's what I had to do to get by, to take care of my family. And that's so much of what is missed when we talk about sort of this commitment to work and to labor, in part because we glorify this culture. Right. This culture that sort of grinds us into literal dust. Right. As we die on these jobs day in, day out. And all we have to show for it are these trinkets. Right. That, again, don't recover all of the things that were lost, all the time I can imagine he didn't get to spend with his daughters. Right. As a single father, all the things he had to miss in terms of their development and maturation coming up, to not be able to miss a shift, right? And like you and I have both existed in like wage employment jobs, sometimes in food services, right? And we know to be true, right, that there were any number of things that we would call out for, right? Legitimate or not, but certainly, right, that there were things we were unwilling to give up and not even having the same type of, you know, commitments that say Kevin did. And so I think there's something about sort of failing to recognize like that this is a necessity that probably shouldn't exist, right? Someone should not have to go to every single shift for 27 years in order to be celebrated, right? That we should simply be celebrated in a bunch of other ways.
Not only that, but like to be there that long, that committed to it and still be working poor, right?
Right.
Like to not be able to like thrive and to still be, it, you know, to still be a situation where a GoFundMe was necessary, right? But like that is the case in so many people's lives around the world, right? Who have worked in the same job or have worked in a career for however long,
right?
To have what to show for it. And I think that's really challenging when we think about it from like the financial standpoint, right? He can say like, I have my kids, I have my family, I have my house, I have all of these great things. It was such a mixed feeling for me that I was really trying to figure out how I was feeling so proud, but also concerned in the same.
And his daughter mentioned, right, like part of the commitment was to make sure he could keep his retirement, right, or remain eligible for it. And yet still, right, even with retirement, that a GoFundMe would still be necessary in order for him to be able to sort of just live as I imagine he would need to. And this is such so emblematic of this moment, right, that like GoFundMes are stand-ins for things that people should basically have available to them. Healthcare and health insurance.
That's a whole other show, right? That we would have to have that conversation.
I feel that.
We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get into, it's a conversation I've been really anxious about. And Charles is like, I'm not tripping. We'll explain it when we come back. Now, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. There are plenty of ways to support a healthy brain, like learning a brand new language or taking power naps. For me, it tends to be taking walks, having full days off, or just being able to get completely away from work. There's also BetterHelp online therapy, though. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat-only therapy sessions, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. I always stress how important that is because I know people who have looked for a therapist for months and years and not even gotten into therapy because it took them so long to find the right person. Getting matched in under 48 hours is extraordinary. And our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fanti. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/fanti. So you've probably heard about microdosing, especially if you listen to Fanti. But if not, just know that all sorts of people are microdosing daily to feel healthier and to perform better. Our show is sponsored by Microdose Gummies. Microdose Gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. I can tell you that microdosing THC and CBD has been really fantastic for me, my friends, and a lot of people around the world. I've also even just recently talked to family members who are now using CBD and THC a little bit more than I even expected them to. If you're interested, Microdose is available nationwide, and you can learn more about microdosing THC when you go to microdose.com and use code FANTI to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, that's microdose.com, code FANTI. Welcome back to Fanti. So by some odd twist of fate, it was exactly a year ago we did part two of our two episodes on colorism. In those episodes, we talked about what it's like to experience colorism. We talked about how privilege works in those kinds of interesting ways that skin tone has an impact on. But we also talked a little bit about like, but what about light-skinned people? Right? Which already sounds a little cringy to me, right? For sure. We had a lot of conversation with listeners about how the isms don't work in both directions and how, you know, like, is it colorism when dark-skinned folks are talking about light-skinned folks, or is it a light-skinned prejudice? Something I would want to get your opinion on in just a moment. I didn't realize that it had been a year that I've been sitting on wanting to have this conversation about being light-skinned. Part of why it took so long is I feel like there's no way for light-skinned niggas to discuss being light-skinned without irony or getting dragged for acting like light-skinned niggas, right? Another part of it is trying to figure out whether or not Travel should be a part of the conversation to bring in their perspective as a darker-skinned person, or if it should be while Travel was away in the spirit of the conversations we've had around gender and non-binary identity. And we decided, like, let's lean into it and, like, do an all light skin show. Laura's light skin, too. We really leaned in here. But the biggest part of the complex and complicado for me is it feels just a little bit uncomfortable to put this in front of a microphone. Like, I've talked to some of my fellow high yellow and red bone friends about this, but I've not done it in public because it feels like complaining about some form of privilege that we've discussed here on the show and out in the world, but like also having to highlight, yes, there is privilege, but there's also like cost as well. And so I kind of, first of all, wanted to ask you, you don't have any mixed feelings about this conversation from what I understand, right?
No, I don't. I mean, maybe mixed wasn't the best choice of words there given the topic of the conversation today, Jared.
Wow.
It's so insidious. It's like, brightest right there. No, I didn't. But I mean,
I didn't even think about that.
Like part of it for me is that I've like had to confront sort of like this light skin thing the majority of my life. And now being someone who studies and like engages with race and racism on sort of a sort of scholarly level and reading so much about it and trying to understand it better, the forced confrontation has allowed me to be like more than comfortable in engaging with this as a topic of conversation in ways that, as you mentioned, most of us don't get to engage in public. Whereas, you know, in my courses or in conversation, I engage with it, you know, most every week.
So I hate to ask you to be a therapist, but like, help me understand why I'm tripping about it.
I mean, it could be a number of things, right? I mean, part of it is, you know, as we've talked about, even in just our own light skin dinner dialogues, if I can call them that, right, is like this notion of authenticity that's ascribed or taken away from how one's complexion is sort of read and understood within sort of the context of Black communities, but also by white supremacy by and large. And I think that that sort of gets at some of the root, right, of like whether we are perceived or understood to be authentically Black, not just based on like the sort of, you know, skin tone politics, but also like language, hair texture, you know, which institutions that we're a part of, all of those types of things that, you know, work, again, in sort of ways that are meant to be understood inside of our community that are not really meant to be understood outside of it. And I think that that's like a complicated thing to do when you're negotiating and navigating that your entire life. I always joke with people, like, I didn't become like Black or like enter the racial trap until 2005, which is like, all right, I like, you know, become Mr. Black Student Union. I had crossed Kappa. I was like, you know, dating really a popular Black woman that was on campus, because there were certain like things that had to happen in order for me to be sort of accepted within this community that would distance me from these sort of like tropes, right? Or these things that were assumptions based on where people understood that I was from, the things that I was a part of in college. And so I think that's a lot of it is just this notion of like wrestling with one's own authenticity in relationship to their broader community.
Interesting. Okay, so let's kind of start off with speech. Mm-hmm. I've talked on the show before about, we talked about code switching, we've talked about our own like personal ways that we speak on the show, but like, I know growing up as me, right, little gay, light skin, Bay Area, whatever the intersections are that we want to name there, I always remember white kids saying to me that I wasn't really Black.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, oh, you're not really Black because I spoke a certain way. We were never like rich. We were never even well off, right? My parents moved to the suburbs and shortly thereafter divorced. And so it was like, well, that was fun, right? And my mom kind of kept us like, you know what I mean? Like she said to me recently, like, it was really important to me to make sure that I could keep you in a very similar lifestyle to what we had pre-divorce. And so like, I couldn't buy another house, but I could like rent one. And so like, mm-hmm. we were in the suburbs, but we weren't like doing well, right? We weren't like rich. I know my grandparents would still like sneak money into my mom's ashtray when we would come over to visit.
Not the ashtray.
And so like, yeah, they'd be like, look in the ashtray.
Why do grandparents do that? Like, they they put money in the most awkward places. Exactly. Forever.
Right, exactly. Like, sneak out to the car. Like, when were you outside?
With butterscotch on
like,
top.
It was, ooh, like a Werther's Original situation.
That's also like, light skin. We're not talking about dark skin candies now. I digress.
I'm not doing that. But like, it was interesting to have people talk to me about how I talk, right? And I remember being referenced as yellow by members of my family, but like, mm-hmm. the conversation about the way that I spoke was always so interesting. And you have like this perspective on it about it being confirmatory. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, there's this notion that's been long debunked sort of in the anthropological literature about this notion of like acting white. Right. Mm-hmm. Or that there's this sort of like, you know, ascription of being able to speak the King's English in a particular way is sort of synonymous with whiteness. But part of what we have to understand is that so much of our even like acquisition of the English language, right, that there were so many things in different dialects and things that we spoke prior to that being forced upon us. It's emblematic, right, of like sort of this larger white supremacist structure that also permeates language. And so when you have, you know, sort of our own schooling experiences where folks who do not speak the King's English in a particular way, right, are made fun of, right, by their teachers, are excluded from, you know, various spaces, which has since been sort of understand more complicated, what we call African-American vernacular English or Ebonics, you know, for those of us came up in that age, that in some ways, speaking in a particular form or fashion, especially as a light-skinned person, is simply more confirmatory about what may be assumed about one's proximity to whiteness. Now, this is not to say that, you know, there obviously aren't many Black folks across generations that have been able to do so and are not sort of questioned about their authenticity, right? And this is historically speaking. We don't say it's about Frederick Douglass, right? We're not talking about this with regard to how Ida B. Wells wrote, W.E.B. Du Bois, Mary McLeod Bethune, like any number of folks whose Blackness is not called into question. And so it's always interesting to me, sort of like this continuum, right, that we're like moving on based on like the aesthetic and then sort of like these performances that, again, sort of call the authenticity of one's Blackness into question. And similarly, right, we think about masters of the English language. I can't think of anybody more masterful than Black people. Right. I mean, just look what we can do with words, right? Like the sort of linguistic acrobatics that come to play in not just like, you know, hip hop in terms of MCs, but like also R&B, but also in poetry, right? Also in essays. Like we just do it better than everybody else. And so the notion of that not being Black is something that we have to sort of interrogate and complicate. But I think it really can be reduced back to sort of Black folks' schooling experiences and all the ways that we're told that we are not sort of doing well or a part of this particular system that only validates and appreciates a certain way of knowing and being.
Okay. One, I'm trying not to plug the book because I feel like it's 100% about this. Like, well, I mean, a lot of it is about this.
For sure.
I was intrigued in our conversation yesterday. You talked about like the hate that light-skinned folks get from darker-skinned folks is anti-Black. And I was like, damn, that makes sense, but I would not have put it that way. Why do you see it that way?
So I think it depends on how we define and understand anti-Blackness, right? So first of all, we have to understand like colorism in and of itself is a white supremacist project. The need to have to make these sort of like semantic differences when, as far as white folks are concerned, white institutions are concerned, we all niggas at the end of the day. But it also needs to recognize that like colorism, right, which is primarily understood with regard to how darker skinned folks, especially within a group, are marginalized within that group and by a larger system of white supremacy, right, is very much a function of how white folks, and we can think about this in sort of the slavery context, right? And it's always this sort of joke, right? Like, oh, there's like field niggas and house niggas. And the house niggas are the lighter skinned folks. And we don't necessarily interrogate that through the fact that one, the house wasn't like the space that one wanted to be in, right? This is also where a lot of sexual violence happened, right, against Black folks in that space. Often those who worked in the house were the products of sexual violence, right? And so the house wasn't no crystal stair, if I can borrow that phrase or term. But also, we have to sort of interpret and understand that sort of the resistance that comes from darker skin folks against light skin folks is also a product of the privileges that we've accrued over time that we deny, right? That we try to equate that we are all the same and have the same experiences. And that often these sort of reverse discriminatory sort of ways of understanding fail to recognize first how discrimination persists and happens. So we talked yesterday, right, of, you know, who had access to education, to jobs and other resources in these earlier periods of American history. It was mostly lighter skinned folks for any number of reasons, right? Whether you're sort of, you know, an offspring of a slave master or other folks who were engaged in sort of, you know, sexual violence against Black women. But I think we have to contextualize all those things and understand that anti-Blackness is a project that denies one's humanity and right to exist, is one that we participate in when we're starting to split hairs about who gets to be more considered authentically Black. And I think that is a thing that we have to really wrestle with.
So as you're saying that, it's bringing back this conversation we were having about colorism versus like skin tone prejudice. Is it colorism in both directions, or is it colorism when it's from a lighter skin or a white person to a darker skin person, but not the other way around?
So typically when we think about isms, right, and isms rising to sort of a systemic standard, right, that there are not just sort of these individual interactions, but larger systems at play that sort of more holistically disenfranchise people. So in that way, we would think of power functioning from a top-down standpoint. And we can think about this in proximity to whiteness, from a skin tone standpoint. So those who are like closer in terms of their complexion towards sort of the white ideal would both benefit and perhaps even participate in the degradation of darker skinned folks, right? We can see this through like these brown paper bag tests and all these other things that are part of the politics of being and becoming Black in a particular era. And so I would not sort of suggest at any rate that what darker skinned folks may say, both in jest and in seriousness against lighter skinned folks, is colorism, because that's not how power functions. We could say that it's anti-Black, that it's part of skin tone politics, but even sort of absent that, right? Think about all the ways in which we can talk about white folks, right? Call them out their name, you know, tell them about themselves. None of that changes the reality of the white supremacist structure that continues to benefit them and disenfranchises us, right? So I think we want to be really careful about, you know, talking about the thing as the thing, but not misequating or creating these false equivalencies, because there is no systemic advantage, you know, that benefits darker skinned folks at the expense of lighter skinned folks.
One of the interesting things about you versus me that is distinctly different is hair texture. Mm-hmm. Right. So like you have, quote, good hair, like straighter hair that curls a little bit, that wavy, maybe I think we might call it, right?
Sure, you know.
That I'll be sure, right. Whereas, like, mine, baby, it is a, it that curl.
That fist.
Whenever I have longer hair, people don't ask me if I'm mixed when I have hair, right? Like,
for sure.
I used to get that a lot more.
Yeah.
But, like, when I have, like, longer hair, they can tell. How does hair texture play into all of that?
It's like any other aesthetic, right? It's like a way to read and calibrate sort of blackness in a certain way, right? And we do this all the time, right? We'll see somebody that we're not really sure and be like, look at their nose, you look at their hair texture, you look at even their like outfit, or all the ways that they try to sort of, you know, manipulate those things, right? In ways that present in certain kinds of ways. But I think that's a clear indication. And even part of that too, is not even just like hair texture, it's like how people's haircuts are. Like if you got the supercuts and you light skin, right? It's like, oh, you probably have one white parent who takes you to supercuts versus like you might have the, you know, the wavy and silky, but you got a crisp line, right? Like when we know you go to a black barbershop, which is even a process of becoming, right? And I've talked to, you know, any number of like biracial friends who talk through sort of their own racialization through the barbershop experience. And like, say for instance, like their dads would have taken them to a barbershop as a part of sort of their being and becoming, not living or existing in a place where that was reinforced. But so much of
okay, wait. Stay there okay. For a second. Unpack that. The idea of like using the barbershop as like a black socialization.
Well, it's a cultural institution, right? It's a cultural institution. It's where so many men and boys sort of learn to become men, right? Both in positive and negative ways. It's a space where black men and others commune, right? In many much ways, like the salon maybe for black women, or depending on like, again, sort of your gender, wherever you find sort of solace in those spaces to do all the things that communities do, right? You talk about politics, you talk about, you know, various events that are happening, cultural moments that are of particular interest. And so much is learned, not just about race, but gender, about class, about all these other dynamics of how you're navigating life, because so many people come to that as a meeting space, right? From all walks of life, right? Like everybody need to get a haircut. I mean, that's, you know, maybe up for debate in some ways, but like this is a place where so many people from different spaces and places can all come and be together. And so you just learn so much about yourself, but so much happens there, right? Like you watch other people who are like you and look like you, especially if you grew up in a suburb that's maybe predominantly white. This may be one of the few times you get to interact with lots of black folks, right? And I know that even for, you know, people who travel like you and me, like the first one or two things that we got to ask somebody when we get to a new city is where do I get my haircut? It's like that serious, not just because I need it, but I need to know where my people are. And then that gives me inroads to other institutions, right? I can find a church home if that's, you know, sort of my thing. If there's like a local hangout spot, all of these things happen in the context of the barbershop and salon. So, you know, part of it is that, but part of it's also the treatment, right? Cause we know like everybody can't treat and deal with the various types of hair that we have. So you also get a place where you're actually loved and cared for, right? In a space that outside of that context often treats you violently and with disregard.
So this is interesting. And I do want to finish up the thought we were on about hair texture. Like when I moved to Florida to be a reporter in Tampa, I remember that first week, it didn't occur to me how few black folks there were until I was like, I need to ask somebody about where to get my haircut.
Right.
And like, I was like, oh, I'll ask one of the black reporters when I get back to the station. And then I got there and I was like, there ain't no black reporters, like black men on the air here. And I was like, oh, I'm the black guy on our air.
Yes.
Right. And I had been there just like for a few days before even starting to recognize that. But like you were talking about how hair texture kind of plays into colorism. And I was fascinated by the way you were talking about parents of biracial children using like the barbershop as a way to kind of socialize their children with blackness. And I cut you there. So I'm sorry.
And even to affirm them. Right. I mean, like, you know, so it's interesting kind of like where we live now, both Brooke and I noticed that there aren't as many black families as we thought there would be. There's like a lot of black men with like white partners. And part of our joke and sort of knowing that, right, is like white women who don't know how to do their black daughter's hair. And mm-hmm. even in like within our own ecosystem, the number of women, white women who will reach out to Brooke about like how to, you know, sort of understand their daughter's curl pattern or like what to do sort of right with their hair. So part of it for me is again, like this read of knowing about who's in and who's out, right? Who belongs and who doesn't, but also knowing that that's sort of like an insufficiency that often many folks, you know, can't provide if you don't come from that particular background or even have an understanding, right? And to be sure, like there's always like a white dude, you know, in a chair in a barbershop or, you know, a white woman that maybe be in a salon, depending on where you are located. But so much of that is just sort of like a read because like, if you are obviously black, right? But like your hairstyle is jacked, right? Like that's going to be a situation. You can't be out here, just be looking a mess, right? You don't have no line. And I remember this distinctly. So my father cut our hair for like the majority of our childhood, but he grows up of a generation where like, you don't taper like this part of it, right? Like he could do like a very tight fade. He's a military person, but you don't do a tight fade. I remember being in like sixth grade and somebody was like, nigga, where's your lineup? And I was like, what are we talking about? What is this line you speak of? Right. And I was like, oh, I get it. And I remember like being in the bathroom one day with my dad's clippers, like trying to give myself a line so that I could like fit in. This is when I like started brushing my hair to the front to have like a Caesar, because I used to curl it back. You know what I'm saying? Like a black congressman, right? All to sort of like fit in to sort of this particular moment. And this is like, you know, late 90s, like that's sort of a big thing. But so much of it was about like the legibility of one's blackness as a, you know, sort of virtue of these particular ways and experiences that often I didn't have, because so much of the black things that I was sort of engaging with was so insular to my family because we moved around so much.
I'm thinking about this hair texture piece and the speech piece again, because I've told the story, but like, I remember when I moved to Clark, Atlanta, it was the first time like I was hearing all the time about the way that I spoke and about being light-skinned. I would be called high yellow and red bone in the same conversation.
Right.
Depending. Right. And like, I remember being asked where I was from and being told that, oh yeah, I sound like I was from California because I talk like I was on the Weather Channel. And I was like, what? Like, I didn't even know what to do with that, right? And it was moving to Atlanta.
Not the Weather Channel,
the
Jared.
The Weather Channel. Mind you, this was in 2005, so... You know, it was a little ways back, but like it was the first day of being in orientation, right? Like we're all sitting at tables waiting for orientation to start. And I remember Kafabian Heard, like one of my classmates, saying that to me and me being like the Weather Channel, which was weird to me because I also like I always wanted to talk like the people on the news, which is why I talk the way that I did. So I was like kind of flattered, but also like, what? Like it was.
Well, to be sure, right? Like the news-ish of it all is like a level above sort of regular white vernacular.
Yes.
Right? There's a certain like eloquence of diction, right?
Absolutely.
A sort of enunciation that takes it to the next level. And I didn't think about that too. So like growing up in our house, my mother was an English teacher for 25 years. My grandmother's librarian for 30, right? So we don't play about language in this house. And I remember like trying to speak the way that my friends spoke at school in the house. And baby, listen.
Not around
we
here.
We was going to get them phonics books. We was going to get them three line papers. We was going to write all these sentences. We was going to have subject verb agreement. We was going to have syntax. I thought about that so much differently as I was older, right? Because part of like being imbued with this ability to navigate language was about survival, right? It was about being able to survive in the sort of larger white world in ways that would hopefully protect us and insulate us from the harms that would otherwise befall us because we spoke in a particular way. We would be typecast or stereotyped, right? By institutions, by people in power. And I don't think we honor that enough, right? This conversation about speech, about blackness, that like so much of these things, how we write, how we talk, how we dress, the way we wear our hair, they were really for means of survival, right? To not be sort of interpreted by white supremacy as a threat, therefore not be engaged with violence. And yet and still, despite all of those things, we still are met with violence. And I think that is the part that we as light-skinned folks have to understand, that we have agency, that these are decisions that we make. And if we don't understand what we're doing, and Black folks more generally, as means of survival, then we take it too seriously. And then we start to engage in that colorism and that subjugation of other Black folks who exist and, you know, navigate the world very differently.
I want to pivot a little bit because in our conversation working on this episode, you started to talk about the effeminization of light-skinned men, the masculinization of dark-skinned women, and you gave like a Halle Berry, Michelle Obama example. And I think like it's a perfect way to explain what you meant.
Yeah. So, I mean, so much, right, of like being a light-skinned man is sort of interpreted through both the hyper-masculinization of dark-skinned men that is sort of made synonymous with blackness, right? So race and gender sort of colliding in that moment and sort of this separation. So we can think of, you know, Drake is sort of the customary example, right? As sort of like the resident, you know, light-skinned people that everyone's aware of. Mm-hmm. But you can think about how Drake was interpreted sort of first coming out, being able to go bar for bar with anybody that's in sort of the backpack rap space and then be singing on the track. And then that being interpreted in a particular way of like whether he's soft, right? Mm-hmm. And we know that soft, right, sort of is this like pejorative euphemism for one who's not considered like a man's man. And so much of that, I think, is ascribed because the sort of also descriptions that happen in the space for Black women, right? That like when women's bodies are commodified in such a way that their primary value in sort of white supremacist capitalist patriarchy is their aesthetic, right? And their aesthetic being valued on their proximity to whiteness, both in terms of skin tone, in terms of like hair texture, how they wear their hair, then all these things are working together. And we can remember, you know, the things that were coming out about Michelle Obama sort of at the time when, you know, they were in the White House, even about like her arms, mm-hmm. for example, right? And then sort of these like characterizations of her in the press as like a gorilla, mm-hmm. right? Things that would never happen to, say, a very fit Halle Berry in Swordfish, for example, right? And obviously very different women for very different reasons, but even the elevation of light-skinned women in the industry and in media is something that plays deeply into the ways in which darker-skinned girls don't see themselves as beautiful, right? There are these sort of controlling images that Patricia Collins talks about, and all these things work together. And I can remember there's this clip that came out, I think I may have been after Kobe's passing, and I forgot one of his teammates, and he was sort of jokey, but he said that Kobe told him in the locker room, like, stop going to the hole like a light-skinned thing, which is basically like, you're going in too soft, you're not going to get the points you need on the board. And so the next play, he like, you know, goes to this extra level of masculinity to dunk on this other person. And part of that for me, right, is all the ways that as light-skinned men who are sort of, you know, effeminized in this particular way, go out of their way to do these hypermasculine and toxic things as ways to sort of demonstrate, right, their sort of proximity to and legitimacy as men. And so we see that in so many different ways, right? Like light-skinned niggas be doing the most, but why is that, right? And what is then placed upon us in order to like be considered authentic and legitimate in this space that requires us to do that?
To this point about, you said light-skinned niggas be doing the most, one, I'm going to reject it and deal with that later. But you said to me in our conversation yesterday that being light-skinned is a verb. And I was like, I've not heard that before, but like, I know exactly what you mean. And like, you already name checked Drake. And I think Drake is kind of like quintessential light-skinned black person of our time right now.
And leans into it.
Right. And is like, this is who I am. I remember Drake talking about when he first was coming in to, you know, prominence or whatever, as a rapper, Wayne saying to him, like, keep smiling, like, do the thing that you do, like, that works for you. And like, I just thought that that was interesting, right? Like,
right.
The ways that we don't let certain people smile or be happy or experience joy, but like, oh, it's a thing that this guy can do here because it works for him. That was interesting to me as we kind of think about light skin being a verb and like it being okay for him to smile. It'd be okay for him to sing a little bit sometimes. And it's okay for him to do this kind of thing.
Well, it was like in the marketplace, right? It was in the marketplace, but it wasn't necessarily in terms of establishing his bona fides as a mm-hmm. rapper, right? Like he's got to rap his ass off and out rap everybody else, even to have a shot, right? And we can sort of, again, like on this longer gradient and continuum towards whiteness, right? It's the same way that like why Eminem would have to show up and rap his ass off in a certain form or fashion as someone who's decidedly outside aspects of sort of racial identification, yet grows up in a context, right, around other black folks to where hip hop is accessible, that like, yeah, you can't come here as a white rapper, as a white ball player, as a white anything into black space and not be sort of like above and beyond, right? And all of that, I think, is about like who has access to an ownership of culture and has a right to exploit it. Because to be sure, right, Drake also has had a certain level of success that no rapper has really ever seen on the popular stage, right? And part of that has to be as a result of not just his sort of being light skinned, right, being Canadian, being any of these other things. But we have to like take that into account because he can say and do things that often like allow to get slid under the rug, right? Because he's light skinned, he can have thinly veiled misogyny in his music and be like, oh, it's Drake, it's different. Right. A dark skinned artist could never do that. Right. And get away with this. So we also have to think about how as light skinned men, right, or light skinned folks generally, we allow that sort of privilege that we have to do the wrong things and still get away with it.
You feel like darker skinned rappers get away with less than lighter skinned rappers?
1,000%.
Say more.
1,000% in terms, because that's just the general setup. Right. Like this is the whole part about colorism. Right. So we had part of our conversation yesterday was the extent to which like we could be doing something exactly the same as a darker skinned person, say, in a store. Mm-hmm. Right. And like the eyes are not going to be on us in the way that they're going to be on this other person. Mm-hmm. Right. Even the police in the situation where both of us are there for the most part. Right. More or less separate, not in like a group, are going to treat and antagonize us differently. We're still going to have very similar problems, but like, we're just not going to let certain stuff slide, or we're going to interpret it as more aggressive, right? And I can think about, you know, any of the extent to which Drake uses the B word, right? And it's not interpreted the same as if it shows up, say, if, I don't know, DMX maybe use it, right? Mm-hmm. Again, different artists in different ways, but yet the word still coming out of a cisgendered, presumably heterosexual man's mouth has the same sort of impact or consequence in terms of society, right? And then who we give permission to do that. And so I absolutely would agree that, yeah, for sure, we don't allow for darker skinned folks to get away with any number of things, right? Artistically or in society, that we allow or give a pass to light skinned folks for doing. Right. And again, that's how racism is structured. That's how colorism works. And that's part of why we've been having this conversation.
I feel like I'm going to go back and listen back to this and be talking at the speaker. Like, I already know, like, when this drops on Thursday morning, I'm going to be like, I got to go back and listen to this again. There's like so much here to unpack. And I feel like we could probably talk about this for
so much.
A much longer time. But Laura's already saying that
we can do a light skin memoir.
A light skin. I'll talk to you about that offline. We want to hear from y'all. Hit us up on social media using the hashtag FantiFam. We're on Twitter and Instagram at FantiPodcast. Coming up, our dishonorable mentions. We'll be right back.
In the briefest time, I feel like we got to know each other.
Bro, I appreciate you so much for that.
Do you read minds or what?
It's really a very sacred space you've created here.
Bullseye! You've hit the bullseye, baby!
Bullseye. Interviews with creators you love and creators you need to know. From MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hey, were you a reader as a kid? Like, maybe you read a lot of fantasy novels.
Or horse girl books. We know how it is.
But now you're an adult and you miss reading. You're so busy and you can't figure out how to get back into books.
We're Reading Glasses, and we're here to help.
Yeah, we'll give you advice to figure out what books you love or learn to stop reading books you don't even like.
We're really big proponents of dumping that book.
Dump that book.
But most importantly, we'll help you fall back in love with reading. Reading Glasses, every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to FantiFam. It's now time for our dishonorable mentions. These are the stories or people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out either for their good or for their stupid. Charles, I'm going to let you start.
So honorable mention, I want to shout out Issa Rae on the LA premiere of her new show, Rap Shit, where she shouts out for sure City Girls, who are executive producers, but actually begins streaming today on HBO Max. So make sure that you check that out.
I want to give a couple of dishonorable mentions. First of all, to most of y'all. Or I wouldn't say most, because I don't know if that's true, but a lot of y'all. I was really fascinated by the response to Jay Ellis and his announcing or like sharing of his wedding. And like, I'm specifically to Black queer people. It's just so interesting to me to see Black queer people, you know, kind of always have something to say about interracial couples. Like, I have friends who are in interracial relationships, and like, I know the kind of shit that they've gotten. But then to see that same Black queer person or people like go and fight for or argue about how we should all be able to love who we love, like, it's just, it's weird and frustrating and like that. And but I also think about what is it like for Jay, who has kind of kept this under wraps for a long time, but also like, plenty of people have known, right? It wasn't a secret, but like, it wasn't something that he was putting on social media. Anyway, I found that whole situation really, really interesting. I'm going to move now to honorable mentions. Two things that I've been watching on television that I'm, or, well, technically three things that I'm watching on television. Number one, Victoria's Secret, Angels and Demons is a documentary on Hulu. Now, the little gay kid in me always loved the Victoria's Secret fashion show for whatever reason.
The little straight kid in me loved it too.
I bet Jared. For different reasons, I'm guessing, right? I just always thought it was like such an amazing show. And like to start hearing like the inside details of what was happening at Victoria's Secret, I was like, of course it was an awful place to be for those women. Like, why was I not, why didn't I think of that? So it's a really fantastic documentary series. It's three episodes on Hulu. And like, there's Jeffrey Epstein in this shit. It's wild. It's a lot. I want to also shout out a show called Severance on Apple TV Plus. Now, I have to be very honest with you. Have you seen it?
Yes.
Okay. I've only been able to watch the pilot because I was so like jarred by the episode, but it is so good that
you have to finish
it. I know I need to get back in, but like I had a little bit of a smoke and I watched the show, and
that's gonna put you in a
I was like, I don't know that I can smoke again and watch this show. It was too, but it's so good.
10 out of 10, do not recommend.
Listen, right? Like, at all. Okay, but Severance, I don't want to tell people what it's about, except it is themed around work-life balance. The reason I don't want to tell you more about it is because, like, I didn't watch the trailer beforehand. I was just kind of, like, I had heard a little bit and just wanted to watch it, so I didn't know what I was getting into, and I think you would really enjoy it that way as well. So check out Severance. The last thing that I want to shout out is P-Valley and my friend John Clarence Stewart, who is going to be on our Black Men in Media panel this coming up weekend, which I'll explain a little bit more. But John has had a fantastic run on P-Valley as Big Teak and has made like a real impact that a lot of people are talking about. So want to give an honorable mention to John Clarence Stewart. All right, it's time for
Black History is happening every day.
Charles, I know that there's a big anniversary that we want to shout out for Black History is happening every day.
Yeah, we want to shout out and recognize Black Lives Matter, the movement that changed all of our lives, that celebrated 9 years on July 13th in their struggle for Black freedom. And that's for all of the BLM chapters, although that do movement work, because we know all organizing is local. And a special shout out to the Dream Defenders, who celebrate 10 years of their work down in Florida for making sure that we can seek justice for those that are victims of state and state sanctioned violence.
I can't believe it's been that long since BLM started, which means that it's been that long since Trayvon. And it's like, it feels like it's been forever ago, and it kind of feels like it was not that long ago. So it's a little bit wild to hear that. All right. Before we go, we want to let you know about a couple of things. If you are in the LA area, I want to invite you to come to Black Men in Media this weekend. We are going to be having our first in-person event for the National Association of Black Journalists here in Los Angeles, and I'm really excited about it. I'm going to be hosting the panel. We will have a fantastic panel of Black men discussing their experience as Black men in media. As I talked about, John Clarence Stewart from P-Valley, you might also know him from Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist or What If over on Netflix. Netflix would not appreciate me getting their name wrong after the kind of week that they've had. So there's that. We'll also have Kevin Merida, who is the first Black executive editor over at the LA Times. He's going to be joining us on that conversation. We'll have Melvin Robert, who is one of our anchors here on Spectrum News, and Montrell McKay, who is the president of Issa Rae's Hooray, working over in development and production. So I'm really excited to talk to these guys about the different ways that they take up space in media, but the similarities that they see across all of their work and experiences. So if you're here in the Los Angeles area, go to nabjla.com. That's nabjla.com. You can RSVP to join us. It is free. Seating is limited, so make sure that you go to nabjla.com. That is going to do it for us. If this conversation piqued your interest and you want just a little bit more of this here good, check out other episodes that have a related conversation. We did 2 episodes on colorism last year. One is called White Supremacy Stank Ass Grandchild with Jarrett Lucas, and the other one is Colorism Part Deux with one of our very favorite listeners, Portia Bartley. We ask that if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, that you give us a 5-star rating and a review. Let us know what you love about the show. Make sure that you go and follow Charles on the social media. Charles, tell people where they can find you on social media.
You can find me both on Twitter and Instagram at HF Davis.
Thank you so much for being here. I feel like I said, I'm going to be probably listening to this episode more than once just to kind of process my feelings and also to be glad that we did this and I don't feel anxious about putting it out. So that is a feat.
The couch is always open.
There you go. If you have a comment or a suggestion about this week's episode, please hit us up on Instagram or Twitter at Fanti Podcast using the hashtag FantiFam, or you can send us an email to fanti@maximumfun.org. You can join us over here in the Fanti Fam by going to maximumfun.org/join and become a financially contributing member of the Fanti Fam. And if you're already a member of the fam, we ask that you share the show. Let your friends know about what episode you loved, how much you think I'm fantastic, or that Travel is the best thing that ever happened. It couldn't possibly be that. Our music is by Carice. Our graphics are by Ashley Wen. And our senior producer is, do you have your air horn ready?
Sure.
You gotta have your air horn for Laura. Are you ready?
Yeah, it's not gonna be a very good one, but I'll try.
That works. That's like warmed up. Okay, here we go. Our producer is Laura Swisher. It kind of died there. It's fine. This
it did.
Is a light skin production of Maximum Fun.
Sponsored by almond milk.
There you go.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
I mean, that's a whole lot of light skin.